Blog Talk Radio.
Father, make light my prayer and strong my faith. Swift my feet and sure my hand to carry your will to the ends of the earth. And spread the good news of your love through the land. Make peaceful the night and bright the day, with angels calling the rising suns. Now high is the road and clear is the way, and finding your presence has just begun. Oh, that the one who has caused the earth to turn and the stars in their crowning glory to bless the skies with a kingly prize could stay so near to my praying. Father, make strong my heart to know your love, and assure my faith to stand on, holding the earth in the palm of your hand. We are your faith-bound
morning, friends. You're on Blog Talk Radio and the Cosmic Citizen with Paula Thompson and Chris Lindbeek Larson. It's a beautiful morning here in Colorado. I hope it's as beautiful in Santa Fe and in Wisconsin where Chris Lynn and Charles are. Today our guest is Mr. Charles Lawrence Olivier. Charles is a longtime friend, and Chris and I both know him well. He is a consummate teacher and just one of the most respected people I can imagine. And Charles, are you with us?
Yes, I am. Good morning, Paula.
Good morning, Charles. So good to hear your voice. We were having some technical difficulties. Chrislyn was having a little bit of a hard time getting in. Chrislyn, are you here too?
I am. Good morning, Charles, and good morning, Paula.
I had a challenge as well. I kept getting an automated message telling me if I had a problem to call an operator. But all is well that ends well.
Yeah, you know, we have some scary situations on Blog Talk sometimes. You wouldn't think that would be the case with a talk radio, but it is sometimes. We at the last minute, everything always seems to work out, and I hope everybody on the board and all of our listeners can hear us loud and clear this morning. We'll try to speak up and enunciate so that you guys don't have any problems hearing us. So today's show is all about angels. If you're interested in angels, I can't imagine that you would find a better source of information for angels than the Urantia book. It's a definitive book on angels. It's just so comprehensive in its teachings and what angels do, what their purpose and function is, what their ministry is, how they serve the universe of universes from paradise all the way down to the material world, the inhabited world, which is where we are. And we've invited, Chrislyn and I have invited Charles today because Charles has a passion for angels and some great insights based on his many studies, not just in the Urantia book, but experiences he's had and studies he's done in other ways. So, Charles, welcome to our show.
Thank you very much again.
We're really honored to have you with us, Charles. Thank you so much.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, it's such a big topic, Charles, angels are. And maybe you want to just start. We're asking our friends today to hold off calling in for the first hour to give you a chance to just really get into depth and some detail about what you have studied on angels and your feelings about angels, what you know about angels. So we want to give you the floor. And just to start, you know, if you could tell anybody something about angels that they may not know, what would that be?
Mm-hmm. Well, the first thought would come to mind is that knowledge of angels leads to good things. In other words, only good can come from knowing about them. And the principal reason for that is that it indicates we're not alone. When I say we, I mean we as a species, as well as us, all of us individually, personally. There is, in modern times, there has developed, unfortunately, I think, a kind of alienation to spirit, to divinity, to deity, to God, to things divine, things invisible, unseen. I think previous ages in world history, human history, may have had less of a problem with this. Faith may have been stronger. Whereas today, reason and science and technology and industry seem to rule. And I don't mean this as a criticism, but one of the effects has been, perhaps indirectly, a kind of alienation for many people, in the sense that they don't belong, they don't fit in, they don't know what their place is in the world, in the universe, in their lives. And the knowledge of angels can serve as an antidote to that, because it first and foremost indicates that we don't exist alone, that we're not alone, that as we struggle with life, as we make decisions morally, personally, socially, spiritually, we're assisted, we're known, we're cherished. There are beings that are attempting to help us, to do their best to guard us and to guide us. So the key lesson in all this is that we don't exist alone. We are known, we are loved, we are cherished. That would be... Yes, go ahead.
How does, you know, and I know how that helps us. You know, we seem to have a hard time with the things that we can't see. We're so material bound, and we tend to think in the dimension that, you know, of our senses, of our own senses, what we can see, what we can taste, what we can touch, what we can smell, what we can feel. And it's hard for us to believe on faith that something is real when we don't have any visible evidence of that. And you know, and some might say, well, that's just a fantasy, that's a fairy tale. So, you know, and I know that you don't feel that way. I don't feel that way. Crystal certainly doesn't feel that way. Most you Rancher Book readers don't feel that way because they've experienced something that is so transcendental. But how would you characterize your experience with angels and why you believe in them so much? You say that you've believed in them long before you found the Rancher Book.
Oh, yeah.
And I have.
Yes.
Why is that, Charles?
Well, that's an enormous question. I'll do my best to address it in a reasonable length of time, but I'll try to be somewhat concise. I think my association with angels, my sense of them, was a result of the influence of two divine spirits in my life. These divine spirits, I believe, influence all of us, or at least are available to all of us. The first is known as the Spirit of Truth, and that was bestowed by Jesus, who his universe role or name would be Michael of Nebanon. That was bestowed by Michael when he left this world approximately 2,000 years ago. And the Spirit of Truth is a comforter. It also helps the mind search out truth, to discern truth. In this case, the truth about angels, the existence of angels and their love for us and their concern and service to us. And the second would be the divine spirit that God has given each of us. Let me make this fundamental point. in my viewpoint, angels, concern about angels, the relationship to angels, is ultimately based upon God. And then I would add Jesus, through whom one can find God. There are many ways to search for God, but it comes down to the first source and center. And so as a child, I attribute my sense of angels. And not so much the knowledge of angels came later, but my sense of angels. And I prayed to them when I was a boy due to the influence of these divine spirits. So my sense of angels was spirit-led. I think that's the first observation I would make, my first understanding, that it was spirit-led. And secondly, I was raised a Roman Catholic. In the Roman Catholic Church, I'm not Catholic now. I left the church when I was about 20 because I did believe in God, and I was hungry for more truth. And I don't really mean that as a disparaging criticism of the church. I think of the church today as one thinks of a loving mother or grandmother. I mean that respectfully and with some degree of affection, no small degree of affection. But I've been very grateful for what the church has given me. And one of the types of knowledge the church passed on to us kids in Catholic school, I went to one in the Bronx in New York City, was born and raised there, was a knowledge of angels and what they did. We learned them in our catechism. And I think that was very helpful. There were two, in response to your question, in my instance, in my case, there were probably two threads. One influenced by divine spirits, and so it was spirit-led, in essence, my sense of them. And then that sense of them was complemented by a slowly but surely growing knowledge of angels, and that first started with the Catholic Church's teachings. The angels figure prominently in Christian art and in some respects in Christian theology, but not all the different branches of Christianity necessarily emphasize them, especially guardian angels. But the Catholic Church does, to a degree, give an emphasis to them. You can see them symbolized in their churches and statues, in paintings, and the like. They figure in poetry and religious poetry and so forth. Prayers, of course. There are many, many prayers, hundreds and hundreds of prayers, particularly the guardian angels. So that church, that school, Catholic church school experience, I think, was seminal and gave me a grounding in what I knew about them and in terms of a body of knowledge about them that I could build on. So I thank the church for giving me a ground to work from. And I'm appreciative of Jesus and our Father, Universal Father, for leading me to them. I can remember praying to them as a boy, which prayer is another very big subject. And while I never have worshipped angels, I only worship God. I've prayed to them frequently, usually to help other people. And later on, if you'd like, I can elaborate on some of that. But as a boy, 10, 11, 12 years old, I can recall, at least that young, sitting in my parents' dining room alone. Nobody was home, I mean, alone in that sense, and asking for their help and their comfort. I think I prayed to them mainly for comfort and help in that sense. But it was a great antidote to alienation that I mentioned earlier. Had I not had that, and of course it's based on faith, this entire conversation is clearly predicated on faith, but if I hadn't had that, I think my life would have been cheaper, less dear, it would have been harder and harsher. Mm. But as it was, I had a sense of their, that's the best word for it, first and foremost, a spirit-led sense of their reality, of their assistance. I may have seen one. I've never, to my knowledge, seen an angel. I've read descriptions and I've listened to descriptions of people who say they have, and I didn't necessarily believe everything I read and everything I heard, although I do believe some of what I read and what I heard, certainly. William Blake, for example, the great romantic artist and poet, talked about seeing them when he was 10 years old. But I may have seen one when and talked to one briefly when I was a boy, probably 6 or 7 years old. I remember I was very unhappy. I was away from home. It was during the summer, and then school was out, and I was visiting my cousins. And I don't remember the reason. I think I probably was 6 or 7 or about that age. In other words, the age of innocence. And I felt socially something of an outcast. I wasn't fitting in. I didn't care for the games the other boys were playing, that sort of thing. And I remember being very discouraged. It must have been a strong event because it's all these years later, 60-some-odd years later, it's still very vivid in my memory. I was sitting on a rock or a log, and I suddenly realized there was a man in front of me. I looked up, and he smiled, and he said something like, tomorrow will be a much better day for you. Uh-huh. And it wasn't the words as much as the way he said them and how they were expressed in terms of the tone, the care in his voice. That's what stood out. And then he was gone. He just was gone. I have to say, he probably disappeared in front of me. He was just gone, and I just took it at face value. I was too little to really rationalize the thing, but it was a comfort. I believed him for some reason. I knew it was true somehow in my heart. And the subsequent events proved to be the case. The next day was a better day. Of course, when you're a child, the moment is primary. That's the whole universe to a six-year-old, is a moment. You're living in the moment. And I don't know that there was an angel. I don't know that it wasn't, but it may have been. Many children have reported similar experiences. Let me read to you something. I have some of my notebooks with me in front of me to assist me this morning. Let me read something about terminal ill kids. I reread it last night. I was very touched by this. This comes from one of the books that I've researched and taken notes on. I'll just read what I quoted from the book. And I think it applies generally to children. Children's stories about the comforting presence of strangers are very, very touching. An angel may appear to anyone, but the most touching stories of visits are those told by children who are terminally ill. These luminous and comforting visitors are so reassuring, the children can assuage some of the grief of the parents, and they're able to convince other equally ill youngsters that the experience of dying is only an easy passage to a happier state. Many times, suffering patients are also blessed with the remission of pain along with the removal of fear. I've listened to parents describe what their children have told them and that sort of thing, and whether the situations are very dramatic or a crisis or not so dramatic, just one is in one's bed at night. Children's stories, I think, are something that people should pay close attention to, particularly the younger children, because there's an innocence with them and a lack of glossing over or overly interpreting experience.
Why would you say that?
I think
so,
that's really true.
Yeah. Listen, I'm not trying to hog the stage here.
No problem. Go ahead.
Okay. Why are children?
Paul.
Why would you think that? And I happen to agree with you, but for the sake of our listeners, why do you think that when a child says it, you know, with that sincere faith, you know, it's more powerful then? Would you agree with that?
Yes. Because of the innocence that children possess,
mm-hmm.
generally speaking. A child, we've raised two sons, and we now have two grandsons, et cetera, et cetera. Children, it's obvious in their lives, and even with high school students to a degree, and this innocence to a certain extent is still there. It's innocence. It's a lack of guile, an absence of deception of a certain kind. A living in the moment is a kind of innocence. And in an adult, it might be called a naivete. But in a child, I think it's admirable. I think it's something that has a certain beauty to it because of innocence.
Well, and you know, I think you hit the nail there when you said an adult, it might be called naivete because we've learned to put filters up.
Yes.
And we've learned to convince ourselves that what we're experiencing isn't real. Or maybe it's just our imagination, or maybe it's a hallucination, or maybe it's one of a number of things, but not real. And children don't have those filters. They allow themselves to experience what they experience without judging it, or without judging it in others, too. And I think it's the judgment of others that makes us doubt our own experiences then. But it's interesting, the experience that you shared is one that has stayed with you all of your life. And you said it may or may not have been an angel. But there was a quality of the feeling, and that's what I go for in these experiences, because what did it make you feel like? Because that's really revealing to me. The feeling that you got, the qualitative experience that you had when that happened, however brief that moment was, it's lasted your whole life for a reason, I believe. So if it wasn't an angel, I think we could be reasonably certain that it was somebody who was ministering to you for God's sake, and we know that angels do that. So that's an important distinction. I've had experiences with angels, and it's always been a qualitative experience. And the quality of the experience is what stays with me. The quality of the love I feel, the quality of the information I get, you know, the quality of the feeling that I have when it happens. I've actually had an experience where I feel like I've cried with them, and it was such a deep sorrow. And, you know, the Urantia book says that they share all of our non-sensual emotions. And it happened to me a couple of times. I feel like, you know, they're all heart. And I tend to lead with my heart, so I'm connected to them through the heart. I know that. Mm-hmm. And I have been able to feel them all my life. I haven't been able to see them or hear them necessarily, but I've always been able to feel them. I've never felt alone. I've always felt their presence. And the day of the Oklahoma City bombing, I was sitting in my office at my desk working, and right about the moment that it happened, I just burst into tears and sobbed. So much that my my associate, Luann, came in and said, "Paula, what in the world is the matter?" I told her, "I don't know. I have no idea." I said, "Something's wrong, though. It's breaking my heart." And it wasn't long after that we got the news that the bombing had happened and all the little children died. And I think that's what I was picking up on. I was picking up their sorrow for the children. Of course, we're all children in their mind, but I think they tend to look at us from a destiny point of view.
Mm-hmm.
Something about that really hurt them. I mean, children die all over the planet all day, every day, you know, as sad as that is. And it helped me to understand how much they feel. The quality of their emotion and the depth of their emotion about that, you know?
Yes.
I think that children also can feel them in a very real way. I mean, I know with my daughter, Reagan, when my stepdaughter, Reagan, had first come to the U.S. and she was sleeping in this big bed by herself, and it was one of the first times she had been in a room alone sleeping, and she was really having a hard time going to sleep and having a hard time sleeping alone. And I shared with her that, you know, she didn't have to worry because she had guardian angels that would be with her through the night and that they're always there for her. And that was the key for her to feel a presence with her in the room, to feel safe. And that really comforted her. And I said, you know, when you start to feel scared, you can ask for that kind of comfort. And that really stuck. I think it really stuck. I mean, we didn't have nearly the same level of problem with that for the next several years after her.
Well, the idea of belonging and of fitting in, of being with somebody, that range of feeling, that range of perception, reinforced by good feelings, is very, very powerful. I believe that many adults are beset with fears in the absence of such a sense or senses. And with regard to children, they're naturally vulnerable. As you said earlier, Paula, they don't filter. They don't really have the senses worked out. Not ordinarily, not generally. And I've taught high school for almost 40 years. I can say that about most high school students. So it's even through later adolescence, that's still often true. Something that's very important for parents and teachers and others to understand, to be mindful of. I think there's a connection, though, between truth and feeling, or there certainly often is. I think truth must often be felt to be understood. That is a point in the Arantra book, and it's in a point in various religions, even in some philosophies. You have to feel truth to understand it, oftentimes. For instance, if love was only an idea or even an ideal, but nothing more, it'd be relatively sterile. If you didn't feel the love you had for somebody, you'd have emotions for somebody, you'd be handicapping yourself. It'd be of great limitation. And the truth about love, truth about any truth, the truth about angels, I think, is something which the modern mind tends to resist because it can't prove it first. And it sounds like I'm criticizing the modern mind in some disparaging way, but I don't really intend to do that. Modern mind has been a great liberating force in many ways. Modern civilization has provided great achievements for us, for human society. Between medicine and democracy and productivity and efficiency, there's a great deal to be said for it. But it has its limits, and I think this is one of them. Faith seems to open the mind to grace, which is a gift from a divine source. It's grace is also a mystery. It's not very easy to define or pin down, but we can feel it. We can sense it. And a lot of truths can only really be understood through the experience of feelings. This is the case in Zen Buddhism. Many of them cannot be rationalized. You have to only approach them through experience. It's almost counterintuitive to the modern mind. And angels fit squarely into this whole issue in the sense that they're beings that are not ordinarily seen. To us, they're invisible, obviously. And yet, all the religious traditions refer to them in one way or another, or mindful of them in one way or another. Quite a few prophets and spiritual teachers have referenced them at one time or other. It would seem there's something to this. If somebody was to, I don't mean this in an argumentative sense, but if somebody was to deny the existence of angels, they would have to then pretty much deny the validity of all the great religious traditions in the world and all the great religious and spiritual minds in the world and hearts. There's a huge segment of art and poetry that have to then discredit as based as not being real. It would seem to me that the credibility might be in the other direction. There might be something to the notion of angels, given that they figure so prominently in the past, But since the 19th century, in terms of the modern world, their presence has been to some extent downplayed. Although there are curious revivals, I read a Gallup poll of Americans and their beliefs in angels, and according to the poll, about two-thirds of Americans believe in the existence of angels. I don't quite know how to account for that, given what I just generalized about modern society. Perhaps people, in spite of what they think, feel there's something to this, something to the notion of human beings being cared for and guarded and guided in some fashion. And perhaps also they want to believe. Many, many people would like to believe. But children are highly credible. They rush to believe something that has touched them, as we've just been talking about. And there are numerous stories of this. And I think that the faith of a child, or the belief of a child, the tendency to believe and wanting to believe, but also accepting what they experienced firsthand, can serve as a kind of instruction for adults. Not in the sense of adults being childish, but in terms of being childlike. There's a big, big difference. And that's one way to think about them, and one way to approach the subject of angels in our lives.
What are some of the ways that they do interact with us in our lives? You've done some pretty extensive research on angels, both in the Arantia book and with other historical reference books. What do you think some of the ways, what are some of the ways that they do directly interact with us?
Well, they specifically engage in character building, human character building. They want us to become strong-minded, albeit perhaps gentle-hearted, but strong-minded, clear-minded. They want us to lead lives that have some real measure of balance. And so they manipulate circumstances in various ways to give us problems to solve, sometimes difficulties. I've observed that a lot of people engage in what I'd call problem avoidance. They tend to avoid the real challenges of living. For instance, their marriage, a neighbor, the parents, relationships between persons, work situations. Angels are concerned with our ability or willingness and ability to grow in decision-making and also to be sincere. So there's that aspect to it. They are very pleased to have people who, in prayer, make themselves available to them to help other persons, other human persons. Every time you pray for somebody else to be of help or service to them, or to have help come to them, you give the angels greater latitude, I believe, to operate, to function. But their primary intervention is concerned with the destiny of our soul. They want us to survive this world in terms of our soul and go on in the afterlife. They want us to live in such a way that we will have a reasonably solid moral and spiritual value in our lives, something that is credible. We can accredit that our life has not been in vain, that we've lived in such a way that it's been worthwhile. And, of course, they foster the idea of God, that they foster God consciousness, not just spirit consciousness or moral consciousness or even social consciousness, but they foster God consciousness. So they have their own agenda, I believe, for us. It's for our betterment in terms of character, the growth of character, in terms of ethical and moral values. If you want to make yourself a better person, then you have to live with a certain amount of courage, moral courage and determination to engage in right thinking and to search out and try to find a right path, something that is well-grounded morally, spiritually, ethically. And I think that they will utilize the higher human morality and higher human ethics in that regard. They'll utilize human idealism. They'll utilize what I call a spiritual idealism. They don't invade the mind, though. They don't manipulate free will. That they do not do. They're forbidden to.
When we're willing and when we make ourselves available, they absolutely do use us.
Yes, but it has to be with our permission. It has to be with our long lines of free will. They have great respect for the sovereignty of free will in us.
We have a question. I'm sorry, go on.
Well, just want to finish. If a person is determined to do something that's foolish, say drink too much, gamble too much, they're not necessarily going to intervene or interfere with that. If you're determined, if you will something that is negative in your life, then you'll have to live with the consequences with that and how that affects other people. The angels are not at liberty to manipulate our wills. They won't do that. They have too much. They have great respect for that. But they are always ready to assist us anytime a person wishes to reform himself or herself, anytime a person wishes to grow in a way that's good.
We had a question from the board that wanted to know if you were familiar with Pierre Teilhard de Chardin and the phenomenon of man.
I'm aware of the book. I know of the book, but I have not read it. Over the years, people, I don't know much about him. I only have a vague understanding. But I respect his reputation. And the people I've known who have studied him to an extent are people who I regard as insightful and knowledgeable and wise. He seems to have been a good influence in the church, even though the church apparently, at one time at least, sanctioned him. But I'm not specifically familiar. Is there a reason why the question was asked and how it relates to angels?
The individual didn't expand. I'll ask. But
I want to share a quote that is so poignant to what you just said a moment ago, Charles, and it's from page 1246. It's about the guardian angels, and it's about their respect of free will, and I think this is so insightful, and it helps us to understand them. It says, in the life of the flesh, the intelligence of angels is not directly available to mortal men. They are not overlords or directors. They are simply guardians. The seraphim guard you. They do not seek directly to influence you. You must chart your own course. But these angels then act to make the best possible use of the course you have chosen.
That's a wonderful statement.
It is, because they will help you make the most of the decision you make. You know, the course you have chosen. They won't try to influence your free will. And of course, there's other places in the Urantia book that talk about free will as being sovereign. It says in another place that the most highs of the universe stand back in merciful respect of the prerogatives of will. So it's you know, obviously another whole show, but I think it's important to just, you know, point that out, that and reiterate what you said, that they don't coerce you or try to influence you. They're here to help and to guard. And there's other things they do too, as well. So I'm hoping you can touch on, in the Urantia book just talks about the cores of angels, the 12 cores, the seraphim throughout all of creation, mighty seraphim, seconathim, supernathim, archangels. You know, so they're a reality that comes all the way down throughout creation.
Well, yes, I would like to elaborate on the nature of guardianship and guardian angels, but you mentioned something else about other things they do. I just turned to page 1255, And I'll just, for the sake of the audience, summarize some of the primary functions of angels on earth. Guardianship of humans.
What paper is that, Charles?
That would be paper, I have to look it up. Paper 114, Seraphic Planetary Government, Section 6. And it begins shortly into that section. The Master Seraphim of Planetary Supervision, it's called. They're angels that deal with revelations and epochs and ages. They assist in dispensation of different historical ages. They're angels that address human progress. There are angels that are religious guardians, that is, the angels of the churches. The angels that are interested in all the religions of the world. There are people in this country that have the sense that only Christianity is angels. That's a very false view. Angels respect all the religions of human beings. Every sincere religious sentiment is something that they hold in high regard. They're angels that deal with the development of nations, at least in the modern period. They're angels that address races. They represent, they have a racial, they look at the perspective of different races on earth. They're angels that deal with the future in ways that the progress angels apparently do not. They're angels who deal with education or enlightenment, and they foster planetary education. They're angels that address health, mental and physical health needs. There are whole organizations of angels that address these various topics. There are angels that promote a better home life, a better family existence in the human race. There are angels that deal with economic development for us. So we have to eat, we have to sleep and be clothed and be housed. These are legitimate biological functions. We are biological creatures, and they're angels that address, promote, foster in various ways, evidently, the improvement of these. They're angels that deal with humor and rest and play, because it's important that human, that's part of being balanced, is to have a sense of humor and to rest and to play. And they're angels that deal with various kinds of emergencies and superhuman ministries, specialized types of ministries. That's just a brief overview of what they generally do on Earth. However, I want to say this. The most important, this is from the perspective of angels, not our perspective, but theirs. The most important service or opportunity for service they can have is to guard the soul and the life of a human being. That is, the development, the soul and the growth of a human being. And guardian angels, in that sense, are more properly known as seraphic guardians of destiny or seraphic destiny guardians. And seraphic comes from the term seraphim, which may have the root, by the way, the root of the word seraph, meaning originally to burn. And that's interpreted by some scholars as lightning or light. And the word seraph may have been originally associated with light of some kind. Hence, seraphim. Angel. The word angel is both a Hebrew and a Greek term, and in both cultures and languages has the same meaning, messenger, which I find interesting, that the Hebrews and the Greeks, two peoples who contributed mightily to the development of Western civilization, and indirectly even to modernity in the modern world, particularly the Greeks, they both had knowledge of angels, and yet gave the same definition to it. It's I've always found the study of angels, and it's not just a study, it's part of my religious life, my prayer life, as I said earlier, to be endlessly fascinating. But guardianship, how angels guard us, is an important subject. Perhaps we can go into that in more detail now or later. Crystalline, did that person get back to you as to why they wanted me to, if I knew about the phenomenon of man?
They were mentioning something about having a Jesuit background and believing that he was also a Jesuit, but that was as far as it went.
I see. Okay.
Well, and we do have a few callers, you guys, but I want to remind our callers that we were going to give Charles the first hour, so we will get to your calls. Hang in there with us.
We also have a lot in our culture about angels being near us and around us, close to us, when we're preparing for death, preparing to pass on. And
mm-hmm.
that seems to be a very broadly accepted idea among many religions, not just Christianity or Judaism. What have you studied in regards to that, other than that what you shared with the, about with the children?
Well, a number of different points. Some of the highlights would be these. When we die, angels are the custodians of our souls and take them into the afterlife, what the Arantropa calls the first mansion world. They're literally custodians. They safeguard the integrity, the identity elements, the structure of our soul, literally. And that's their key function. And there are certain aspects of human consciousness that go along with that. But over the years, I've read of a number of experiences, and I've listened to people who have talked about individuals prior to death having experiences that seem to be somewhat in common. There seems to be a commonality among many people in this regard. And I'll give you some examples. A lot of people have said when they watch somebody who is about to die and then dies, that just prior to the death itself, they smile. Lincoln was said to have smiled just prior to his death, in the morning of April 15th, after he was shot in the evening. That happens fairly often. I've heard nurses talk about it in hospitals, that sort of thing. And people, family members, describe other beloved individuals who were in the dying process. The second thing is a number of people who, if they're able to speak, and this includes adults and children, talk about seeing other persons in the room.
Right.
And that seems to be somewhat common in various circumstances. I don't know about war, for example, when men die violently and suddenly, but if a person, my sense is if a person, from what I've read and what I've heard, been told, if a person has, if the circumstances permit, they have time to do this, they often identify other people. I remember people telling me, well, somebody will say something along these lines, who are they or who are you? And they're not talking about the human persons in the room, the say family or friends that may be there. They clearly are not. They're looking either past them or around them or before them. And I tend to accept that at face value, that the people are not going to make up stories when something as grave as death occurs or as serious as death occurs. It's a tremendous experience, of course. They probably saw what they saw, and were simply reacting. It generally happens relatively soon before death, shortly before death, is the sense that I have. And the Arantropa book, I can't think of exactly where the reference is. I could find it eventually, but that there is a zone between this world, between this type of life, this mortal material life, and the next type of life, which the book calls Morantial. Without going into that too much, there is a zone, a mid-zone between them, or a borderland, that the human mind, somehow or other, not in every person's instance, but for a number of people, for reasons I don't understand, but the human mind is capable. Something happens to human consciousness when he or she knows they're about to die. Their consciousness is altered. And the Ranch book talks about this, and I believe that. And how it works, I do not know. But somehow they're able to see that which they could, those whom they could not see before, because of a change in consciousness. It's somehow mind, not the brain necessarily, but mind is altered in this fashion. But in any case, these experiences, according to people who witness them in the dying, are very comforting. They're very reassuring, even if sometimes a little surprised, such as "Who are you?" or "Who are you?" "When did you get here?" or something like that. But they apparently are very comforting. And again, children talk about this as well as adults.
Well, you hear a lot of deathbed stories about angels, and even the Urantia book mentions that angels don't really have wings.
No.
And that misconception comes from deathbed experiences, where what the person was seeing was the transport seraphim. And the transport seraphim have friction shields that allow them to travel at high velocities through the universe, and they take the soul of the human to the mansion worlds. And so the last thing they see before they die is this transport seraphim is getting ready to whisk them away. And they have described these friction shields as wings. Just a little trivia, I guess, from the Urantia book. But it's fascinating to me that we humans, and it makes you wonder, our what we conceptualize often is based on our frame of reference. And so if something looks like wings, must be wings. We didn't have any other frame of reference for that. So I imagine them in my heart and in my mind's eye, the transport seraphim getting ready to take off is just like a pulsating bullet of light.
Mm-hmm.
Wouldn't it be a thrill to see one? We'll all get to experience it, although we won't be conscious of it. But
yes,
it would be a thrill to see one of them taking off.
I've heard
that they've allowed that at times. Special dispensation allowed humans to witness certain things.
They do. I've noticed generally if those dispensations occur, and in a sense they are dispensations, it's because of the spiritual and moral maturity of the individual. They're not done across the tiltilate. They're informed, and these individuals are capable of appreciating at a mature level such visitations, such appearances. The idea, by the way, that angels don't have wings is not unique to the Urantia book. Over 1,000 years ago, one of the now more respected Christian writers and artists, Hildegard of Bingen, stated they don't have wings. I don't know how she reached that conclusion, but she stated it bluntly.
Wow.
In early Christian art, in catacombs, because the Christians, of course, were oppressed, generally speaking, in Roman society in their earlier generations, they had to hide to survive. And some of the earliest art we have, images of Christian images of Jesus in art, of angels, of the apostles, of Mary, are found on the walls of these catacombs. And there are instances where these angels don't have any wings. And they appear somewhat later, a few hundred years at least, in Christian history before they appear with wings. The Greeks, the Babylonians, the Egyptians, they put wings on various beings. Wing victory is the most common instance. And that's usually assumed to be the reason why in Christian religious art that they were attached with wings. But there are, I have hundreds and hundreds, I suppose I have a few thousand images of angels in many books that I have, and early postcards, etc. There are quite a few examples, dozens and dozens of examples without wings. But wings, you said something about the way people understood, the way people could understand their ability to move about in time and space was helped by the image of wings. I'm making an analogy to birds, of course. We're only capable of describing something in terms of the vocabulary of our culture. Unless you have somebody with a very bright mind, a very rich imagination, and they can imagine something outside their own culture, or they've seen something outside their own culture.
Yeah.
But they don't have wings, and they don't have beards. There's a natural human tendency to anthropomorphize these beings, to you romanticize them, of course, it's natural. People want to feel the, express their affection or their awe of them, but they don't have beards and wings and that sort of thing. They're not humans. They never were humans. They were created by the universe mother spirit. They're daughters. In the branch book, they're described as daughters of the infinite spirit. Although they're under the sovereignty of Michael of Nebanon, they're made of spirit. They're an entirely different type of creature than us. But they do have a kind of personality, and they do have intellects, and they do understand us intellectually and emotionally. They don't understand why fear, they have a hard time comprehending or relating to how fear is so prominent in human consciousness. But they share our higher emotions, our more spiritual emotions and friendlier emotions. They certainly share our intellectual life in the sense they appreciate the use of reason and logic, and they understand what facts are and numbers and that sort of thing. These are not ephemeral creatures. I mean, they have a strong sense to their existence.
You know, speaking of angel comfort, I'm reminded of the mighty angel that came down in the garden and comforted the master when he was in such distress. And, you know, it pains me to even read that story, because it just, I cry every time I read it, that, you know, great drops of sweat fell off of his brow. He was so heartsick thinking about his apostles. And this mighty angel came down and comforted him. So there's a real, you know, they do comfort us. They are able to give us real and present comfort in times of distress. And someone on the board just said that his friend was on his deathbed, and a mighty angel came and comforted him. And it's hard to imagine how comforting that would be, or that is, you know, if you haven't experienced it, but I can trust that it's pretty special. Someone told me recently that having this divine relationship with divine beings, that nothing could be more romantic than that. And that just really touched me. Nothing could be more romantic than having a relationship with a divine being. Wow. That was a great insight. I really appreciated that one. Someone asked on the board, Charles, if you could comment on the angel Moroni from the Mormon tradition.
I don't know much about him, so I won't be able to. I just know of his existence. I wish I could. I have great respect for the Mormon tradition and their religion, and I'm intrigued by many aspects of it and the emphasis they place on angels. The heavy emphasis, the great emphasis. But I don't have anything specific to say about him specifically.
Okay. Shall we take some calls, you guys? These folks have been waiting quite a while.
Sure.
Very patiently, I'm sure.
I want to just make one request, and that's that we get back to the topic of guardianship and what they do. So let's try
to
weave that back in if we get distracted.
There
we might have specific
three or four
questions
points,
about that.
Important points on that, certainly.
Okay, go ahead, Paula.
Okay, great. 215, you're on Blog Talk, The Cosmic Citizen. Area code 215, are you with us? 215? Area code 215, are you there? Hello? Code 215?
Human technology has its limits. Evidently.
This person is waiting so long, they may have had to go to the bathroom or something.
Yes.
215, are you there? Okay, well, darn it, I'm sorry about that.
Is there somebody else in line?
Yeah, there is. So we'll try that. Sometimes there's a delay, a slight delay. Area code 603, you're on Block Talk Radio, the Cosmic Citizen.
Hi, Paula. Charles, Crystalline, this is Reed.
Good morning.
Hi, Reed.
I was just listening, but, you know, I do have a little thing that I could share. 15 or so years ago, I had a strange thing happen to me. I was backing up a dump truck and getting ready to, to dump it. And my back tire and front tire on the right-hand side at the same time sunk in, and I started to roll over and down an embankment. And the normal me would have probably cussed or something, but for some reason I just said, God help me, which was kind of strange, but very apropos, because something took my body and turned it 90 degrees on the bucket seat and made the legs of this person, me, walk. And as I was walking, I was in a sitting position, and so I walked and ended up walking and landing on the roof of the dump truck, all the time watching the windshield pop out and crack and everything. And right in front of me was an open window, and so I bailed out. Of course, I left the diesel engine running. I had to go back in afterwards and try to figure out where I was and shut the engine up. But something moved me and basically saved me from some heavy injury, you know. And I often wondered what it, you know, it just blew me away. That's it.
It's an amazing experience. I've heard other stories.
Thanks for sharing that.
Charles, I'm sure you have too.
Grateful for that, and I think I had quite a bit of spiritual growth at that moment too. But anyway, that's my story.
I think, Reed, the two things that I took from that, the first one is that you asked for help, that you asked God for help. I think it's important to ask for us humans to ask, to seek.
Yeah, it surprised me that I did at that moment, because intellectually, if I had thought about it, I would have said, yes, I would ask God for help. But in the physical me of living at the moment doing this physical labor, it was just very strange that I remembered calling out, God help me, rather than dag nabbit, you know?
Yes, and the other thing is that I took from what you said is that... if I understood you correctly, you have enjoyed, to some extent since then, some degree of spiritual growth?
Oh, yes.
Well, perhaps that was all part of the package.
Yes, it must have been. Anyways, time will tell, and someday I'll know more about my experiences.
Yes, we don't know, we can't say for certain, I can't say for certain anyway, I'll speak just for myself, whether or not it was an angel.
Yeah.
It could have been. It can't be something that can be ruled out. It certainly could have been. I don't think guardianship necessarily means physical guardianship, although it may, can, and has. But it certainly is an interesting story, and it has value.
Yeah.
It has a good deal of value.
Well, I hadn't dedicated myself to studying the Revelation at that point, so maybe that was why they wanted me to be alive and well, so that I could finally make up my decision to read the Urantia book.
Well, that certainly is a reasonable interpretation, isn't it?
Yeah,
I think quite reasonable. Well, thank you for sharing it.
Well, thank you, and I'll just listen now.
Well, thank you, Reed. Thanks for calling in.
Yeah. God bless you all.
God bless you.
Thank you, sir.
God bless.
Charles, why do you think that our desire is the key?
Our desire is to what?
Why is that? What, you know, you made the comment to Reed that you know, he asked. That was something that stood out to you. He asked. For
yes.
Help. And why do you feel that is so important?
It's critically important because prayer enhances the efficacy of action. the efficiency, the possibilities. It broadens the latitude for angelic action or divine action. I don't mean to say angels are divine, but either spirit-led action or angelic action is enhanced, is broadened. Because when you pray, you're using your free will, literally, to open up possibilities that, to realize more possibilities. You're opening up a range of what can be done in terms of respecting free will and the consequences of free will. In Reed's case, it was not his fault. He didn't have the desire, or the truck, something went wrong with the truck because of the ground, and then it started to roll. He could have been killed, or, as you said, bad, very seriously and permanently injured. I don't know what would have been, if that would have happened otherwise, if the help he got would have happened otherwise if he hadn't asked. But there's something about asking, and I don't fully understand this. There's mystery attached to it. There's grace attached to it. Somehow or other, when you ask sincerely, you call upon a higher power sincerely. There's more leverage possible in terms of something becomes more feasible as more leverage. I think I'm being a little awkward in trying to express it, but I don't fully understand it. But my sense is that the efficacy of prayer is enhanced when we ask, because we involve ourselves more fully. There's a connection between faith and free will and superhuman ministry of various kinds. They're all, I believe, interconnected, interrelated. And if you're a student in a classroom and you don't ask the teacher for help, there's going to be a certain consequence of that. But if you do ask the teacher for help, then you position yourself in a better way. Things become more open, more available. You really have to ask. I'm not sure that prayer, we humans at least we religionists anyway, those of us who believe in divinity, the existence of divinity, of deity, would do well to better understand prayer and to use prayer more frequently. It's not it's no coincidence. It's no a slight point to point out that Jesus prayed frequently. Now, he usually didn't pray for himself, but that's beside the point right now. He did pray frequently. Prayer, in the book, of course, there's about 24 different, almost two dozen different ways in which prayer functioned for him. I mean, prayer could calm your mind. I've used prayer, silent prayer, almost always, as a classroom teacher, as a high school, public school teacher, as a technique of classroom management. Those prayers were always answered, always. I've used them for hundreds and hundreds of times, if not thousands of times, and I just lost track. When you pray, you enhance the leverage of superhuman ministry in some way. I discovered this some years ago, and it's certainly certain kinds of prayers can certainly have an effect with your angels, for sure. Particularly prayers for to pray to for help in the situation that Reed was in is perfectly legitimate. We are physical beings, and we're built not to like pain. We don't like pain. That's normal. We want to get away from pain. Any organism will do this if it can. That's certainly a reasonable thing to pray. But my guess is there must have been something in Reed's character that could be responsive to the spirit-led ministry, so that the help that he received, which was the way he described it, was highly unusual. And I just take what he said in this case at face value. That's what happened. It's a very plain description. The help that he received benefited him spiritually. Well, that means there's something in him to be benefited spiritually. And I think this is all interconnected. But that's why I asked him about his spiritual growth. when Jesus ministered to people, he really wanted to minister to their souls, to their spiritual health and welfare, most of all. And when he did something to help people, it was that long view that he had in mind. I think from the perspective of superhuman ministry, it's that long view, including the angels' perspective. It is the long view they have in mind. So if they intervene, it's with that long view in mind. But you have to ask. If you don't ask, like the student in a classroom, not necessarily it's your fault, you're just going to limit yourself.
Right.
A child will naturally ask his or her parents for help, and they'll go on doing that unless the parents are indifferent. And the health of the child depends on that, but it's natural to ask. It's natural in children. And in adults, in an adult spiritual life, a childlike faith, again, is very desirable. Asking is part of it. I've known a lot of people, come to think about it, who won't pray to their angels. They won't pray to God because they think they're too busy. I've heard this any number of times. Or they can't be bothered. I'm just a little person. Why would they bother with me? It's a very unfortunate, in my opinion, a very unfortunate perception. But asking does enhance the efficacy of prayer, the leveraging of prayer, of superhuman ministry.
There's a person who's new to our board and is interested in reading the Urantia book, and I was just mentioning that there are a few papers that are just dedicated to the study of angels. What are some of the things that you have learned about the nature of angels and how they guard us, etc., from reading the Urantia book that you would not have otherwise known?
Well, let me say first, in my studies of the world's great religions, and comparative religion is a major interest of mine, has been for years and years and years. I've taught it to high school students. I've used Houston Smith's book, The World's Religions. The Urantia book has a far more sophisticated, in my opinion, a far more sophisticated exposition or description of the origin, the nature, the ministry, and destiny of angels. Much more precise, specific, detailed. Just generally, I'd recommend it for that reason. There are four papers in particular devoted exclusively to them. Of the four, I'd recommend especially papers 113 and 114. If that individual read nothing else but those two papers with regard to angels, they would learn, I think, a great deal that's worth learning about these beings whom I've called unseen friends and allies. Do you want me to comment on the nature of guardianship?
The papers he mentioned were paper 113 and 114.
Yes.
That those specifically will really help people understand a great deal about angels.
Mm-hmm. The 113 details, I think, with great amount of precision and specificity, the nature of guardian angels. And their ministry, their functioning and ministry and destiny, so especially their nature of functioning and ministry. And paper 114 describes the government of angels on earth, which the paper calls a seraphic planetary government. And I read from it earlier. I mean, I summarized from it, paraphrased from it earlier. The angels are well organized. They're systematically arranged for the benefit of civilization as well as individual persons and groups of persons. Those two papers are very, very worthwhile, I think. Very valuable.
Thank you. Yes, would you please comment more on guardians and the nature of guardians? And is there, you know, this was something the Urantia book told me that was very intriguing to me. The highest honor for an angel is to be given a human to God.
Mm-hmm.
This and the book does describe that not everybody has their own personal seraphic guardian. Seraphim also being another word for angels, right? And that some angels have a group of individuals to guard, but the highest honor is to be given an individual.
Mm-hmm.
And there's an implication that of ascension, and if all goes well, that person and those angels and every seraphic guardian is actually two angels, one aggressive, one retiring. They're a true complement to each other, and they have assistance. So if you have a guardian angel, you actually have a little troop. That's the way I think of it, and they will go with you all the way to paradise. This is the thing that really intrigued me. That guardian, that pair of angels, will stay with you from here all the way to paradise throughout your long ascension and
mm-hmm.
your ascending. Just awesome to me. There's an incentive there, let's say. There's a wonderful incentive for them. Not
yeah.
that they need that, but I just think it's noteworthy.
It's very noteworthy. It puts it in, the word perspective comes to mind. It gives perspective to our relationship with the angels and theirs with ours, with us. This is their relationship to us. It's not limited to this world, to this earthly experience on your rancho. It's much, much bigger. It's much vaster, much grander, and nobler, and very beautiful. They are our friends, not just our associates and guides. They're our friends. Friends in the sense that Francis Bacon referred to friendship as a virtue.
Mm.
They do care about us. They do love us. And they do try to understand us, and they do try to help us in a myriad of ways. As I mentioned earlier, to grow in terms of character, etc. But they are our friends. And the listening audience should take that as friendship in their understanding of friendship in the best possible sense. There's a statement in the book that the presence of a true friend robs bitterness of much of its sting. That's emphasizing the negative, but there's also the positive side. Friendship can heal. Friendship certainly comforts, but it can also heal. It can sustain. It can lighten and clarify. And friendship is companionship. There's a camaraderie with it. And we will enjoy their companionship for vast amounts of time and experience as we ascend in the universe. There'll be times when we may separate and then come back together again later, but we'll always be connected, no matter where we may be as individual persons in the universe, at any moment, so to speak, and where they may be, our angels, if they're not with us. They'll always be mindful of us. We'll never be forgotten by them. We're reassured of them. We'll never be forgotten. They will always cherish us as their friends. And that's something the world, I think, needs to know, needs to be more aware of, that that's part of guardianship. That's probably the most important, one of the most important aspects of guardianship is friendship. They are our mentors as well. I think of guardianship primarily as mentorship. They mentor us. They mentor the growth of our character, the growth of our minds, the quality of our minds. They're very concerned about our intellectual poise and balance and comprehension. They mentor our search for truth. They mentor the search for truth, beauty, and goodness, the seeking of truth, beauty, and goodness in our lives, in the lives of others. We're all aware of hundreds of stories of people being helped physically, as Reed was, which may or may not have been a particular angel. The angels aren't the only beings around, but they're the primary, I call them our primary workhorses. And but they certainly are concerned about the quality of mind and the quality of soul in us. And they foster those qualities. And they, in fostering us, they mentor us. So I think of guardianship as mentoring. And there's another corollary point to all this I think is very important. Spiritually, we're all equal before God. The Ranchwick makes that crystal clear. All peoples, all individuals are on an equal footing before God. Jesus even used that expression on one occasion. It's called the doctrine of equal footing. We're on an equal footing before God. And the angels fully recognize this and abide by this, of course. If they differ in how they treat us or how they try to mentor us, it's because of function, not value. What I mean is, we're asserting that we have an equal footing before God as individuals, that God loves all, there are no favorites. That's a value judgment. The angels value us as persons equally, as children of God. They respect us and have affection and respect us. Functionally, we're not equal. We're not equal biologically, socially, intellectually, physically, in many ways. And they have to work with what they have. They have to work with a certain IQ. They have to work with a certain level of education or lack thereof. They have to work with a certain moral character or lack thereof. So they function differentially. And that's a fundamental distinction to valuing us equally as children of God. I once explained to a student who felt his parents did not love him. He was adopted. And these kinds of conversations are very difficult and very tricky. And I've had a number of them in various degrees, as you can imagine, as a teacher. And I tried to convince him that his value as a person was unaffected by how his parents may or may not have treated him. That was the best I could offer him in the moment and come up with it. The best insight I can offer him. He had an absolute value as a person because he was a child of God. Even as a classroom teacher, when I'm talking to students who are desperate or in crisis, I will sometimes be very frank with religion because the need is so great. You have to experience these kids to understand what I'm saying, to really appreciate what I'm saying. Many of our young people are lost. Talk about not knowing or understanding about angels. They're lost in a very big way. They really don't have a sense of who they are, why they're here, especially why they're here, and no sense at all of where they're going, none at all. And that's fairly common. It doesn't seem to matter, gender, race, class, do not seem to matter very much in this regard. How they're brought up and how they're loved matters a great deal. That matters a whole lot, irrespective of gender, race, or class. But the angels, as I explained to this, why I didn't bring the angels into it, but they value us the way God values us as children of God. Because as children of God, we are literally their brothers and sisters, if you will. We're all family. We're literally family. From a spiritual, cosmic perspective, we're literally family. And they frame the relationship in that larger context. But they do have a differential function. They have to. Because they have to work with what they have in terms of human beings, with human foibles and liabilities and human assets and potentials. That sort of is the main point I wanted to bring out.
That is such an important point, Charles. I mean, you know, we humans, we judge each other and we hold each other in contempt. But our unseen friends and allies don't do that. They can't.
No.
They can't afford to do that, because if they did do that, none of them would come here to help us. We would not be worthy of their help. And maybe that's what's at the heart of us holding each other in contempt, is our belief that we aren't worthy of their help. But they don't look at us that way. They have such an enlarged perspective of who we are and who we potentially could be. They look at us like we would look at a one-year-old. We don't judge them because they can't talk and complete sentences yet. We don't even, that doesn't even matter to us. We look at them in their absolute beautiful potential, and we do everything we can to help them learn to do the very next thing they need to learn to do, which maybe is to walk or, you know, something really basic. And I think the angels look at us that way. They don't hold us in contempt. I think that's the important thing to remember. And you said, you know, there are angels of the races. There are angels of the churches. There are angels of the religions.
Yes,
and it's the same thing. They don't judge our feeble attempts at faith or at understanding God. They know we're little. In a spiritual sense, we're like little children to them. And so I just think that's such an important thing to highlight, that, you know, they're looking at us. They have a big picture. They have a really big picture. And we have a really small picture. You know?
That's true. There's an interesting causality or relationship between perspective and perception. If there's a Native American image I've kind of created, I borrowed from Native American religion, the ant and the eagle, that is the perspectives of the ant and the eagle. Both are respectable. The eagle does what eagles do and ant does what ants do. But the ant's perspective is necessarily circumscribed. The eagle flies the highest and sees the farthest. And oftentimes that's the difference. Many people live their lives with an ant's perspective. They work hard, they're busy, they're in a hurry. Many times they're too busy to grow. Whereas some individuals acquire somehow the eagle's perspective. I think that's how the Arantra book can help a lot of people. Is that it gives you the eagle's perspective of reality. And when you have a broader perspective, your perception will be deepened and enhanced. And there's something else also. I think it's a paradox. The ability to live well in the moment is paradoxically highlighted, enhanced, by having a greater perspective of the past and present, of the past and future, or the past and destiny. Mm-hmm. And the angels try to assist us in terms of our perspective, so that our perception deepens, and hence we're capable of greater growth. And that's also part of guardianship. The word guardian is often interpreted, obviously, in the physical sense, that they would save somebody from pain or death. And it has validity. To what extent, I don't know, but that's not their primary aim. The book uses the phrases guard and guide, which you also used, to guard and guide us. Well, guidance is certainly the mentoring part of it. And they're guarding us so that they're trying to guard us so that our souls are preserved, so we have a future in the afterlife. In one way, it's very complex. It's a very complex process, because it's as complex as life is complex. Human life is very complex. Another way, it's very simple. It's a curious thing. When they function differentially, not again value, but when they function with us differentially, it's based on our attainments in the circles of intellectuality and spirituality. It was human achievements, human intellectual and spiritual and moral achievements. A lot of people don't realize we have much more, through free will, we have much more say-so than many people might suppose. And if you're working... if you're living in such a way that you're searching for truth, you're searching for beauty, you're searching for goodness in your life, in the lives of other people, in relationships, and you want them, and you value them, you provide with your angels, your guardian angels, a lot of material to work with.
Mm-hmm.
You give them, and to the extent that you achieve moral and intellectual and spiritual insights and knowledge and experience with people, actually living experience, you achieve this. Manifest an experience. You enable them to guard you, if you will, a great deal more closely, in a sense. You give them a lot to work with. And that's part of the human responsibility of living. We have responsibility, if we want to grow, to try to grow as persons, regardless of our background. Many people have difficult childhoods. I did. Many people do. But why remain a prisoner of them? In terms of the repercussions. I tell this to my students, I'm retired now, but I told my students, I doubt there was a class that went by, this didn't come up. Don't be a prisoner of your fears. You don't have to be. It may seem that way, but it's not true. It's a fraud.
I just said that it's just so important. It's so important. I want you to say it again.
Well, I wish I could have. As a public high school teacher, I was restricted constitutionally as to what I could bring in terms of what I believed in terms of religion. But I tried to paraphrase as much as possible for their sake, because again, you only have to work with young people. In my case, high school adolescents, people roughly ages 14 to 18, to appreciate how lost so many of them are, how confused so many of them are. The angels will function to us in direct proportion to our moral, social, intellectual, spiritual achievements. And they will try to advance us, yes. They'll try to help us grow, go beyond whatever stage we're at. But they do depend, to a certain degree, on what we do for ourselves in those senses. And but it's helpful. The statement, only good can come from knowing about angels, is helpful because, as I said earlier, it means we're not alone. And that, in turn, helps people to potentially, and it has the potential to help people believe in themselves more, not be so fearful. If you don't think you're alone in the existential sense, or even experiential sense, you don't believe you're alone. That is, if you believe that someone knows you, somebody knows and cares about you, then fear has a more difficult time to take hold of your mind. If you think you're alone, if you feel isolated in life, however it's expressed, or however it's manifested, then fear will tend to dominate. You'll tend to allow fear to dominate you. And I've always promoted the study and knowledge of angels, at least that, if not more, precisely for that reason. It's an antidote to fear and all the harm that fear does to the human mind, to human consciousness, to God consciousness, spirit consciousness, even social consciousness. Fear is a terrible debilitator. And the angels do everything they can to combat that, to deal with that. But they do require our cooperation. That goes back to asking. It's important to ask, as I pointed out to Reed. It's very important to ask. There are all kinds of ways of asking. You can ask by impulse. You don't have to sit down. My prayers are all conversational. But you don't have to sit down. It can be by impulse. A simple desire. They recognize that as a request. It's helpful to the person to direct the question to something to suit the human ministry. That's where knowledge comes in, and faith, I guess, comes in. But they will respond to any human desire for something better in the context that we've been discussing that. But it's so important.
Well, I think that, you know, you touched on several really important things, but fear is certainly, and the book says that angels do not experience our fear. I think there's probably a very practical reason for that. They don't have a body. And, you know, I think fear really is nothing more or less than remembered pain.
Mm-hmm.
We experience pain, whether it be heartbreak, which perhaps is the worst kind of human pain, the loss that we suffer, you know, and a broken heart about that loss, but also, you know, various degrees of sickness and illness and physical pain that we can't forget, and it makes us afraid.
Yeah.
And to one degree or another, it probably happens when we're little children, you know, the first time we ever burn ourselves. And it's just the intensity
mm-hmm.
of pain is, you know, it's important when you have a body to have it, because you'd be doomed without it. You have to remember that certain things you cannot do. You have limitations, and pain teaches you that. But by the same token, it can get into your psyche and be the reason that you do things. It can be a motivator beyond what it should be. rather than alarm clock, you know, to warn you, hey, danger, some people let it go off in their head constantly. And they're always afraid of the, you know, the what if this happens, oh, and then it will be dreadful. And everything they do is to stop that dreadful pain from ever happening again, which a certain amount of that you can't stop. You just have to embrace the fact that you'll probably feel pain again because you're in a body. But I understand why angels, you know, wouldn't feel it like we do. They don't get sick and die and get old and, you know, hurt and suffer like we do with physical pain. But there's something to be learned from them in that. And again, it's what you said, Charles. It's about perspective. They're giving us, you know, a higher perspective that, hey, you know, this pain you're feeling, it's temporal. Our good friend Daryl Strider says, you know, humans add resistance to pain to make it hurt more and last longer. And I think that's true. You know, we spend an awful lot of our time trying to avoid pain, when in reality, if we just embraced it and moved through it, we'd get through it faster. And
sure.
We could move on. Move beyond. We do a lot to keep ourselves out of pain. We addict ourselves to certain substances or drugs, all of this so we won't feel pain. And I know there's varying degrees of pain, and I'm not certainly not slighting anybody who has to live with constant and chronic pain. They have to have some help with medication. But, you know, it's just an interesting thing, a distinction between angels and humans that a physical body creates. But I think someone once told me an angel is like the person standing on a bridge and there's a big accident on the highway. They compared what's going on here on this planet to a big accident on the highway, a multi-car pileup, and it's just a disaster and everybody is in absolute chaos. And they're just panic-stricken and they don't know what to do. And the angel is that the being with the higher perspective standing up on the bridge saying, look, it's okay, you guys. Calm down. Help is on the way.
Hmm.
I can see the ambulance coming. You know, I can see that the help is coming. So just calm down. You're going to be okay. And as visceral as that comparison was, it was really helpful to me.
Mm-hmm.
You know, when you're down here and you can't see the forest for the trees, you know, and it just seems hopeless and helpless sometimes, it's nice to have that perspective that someone's got your back, and it's what you said earlier, you know. Someone cares about you. Even though you can't see that being, they're there, they care about you. And they've got your back. That's important to know.
The notion that we are known and loved, and to know and be loved, to know and be known, and to love and be loved, is so basic to human happiness. It's a difficult one for many people to believe. I think partly because of invisibility, the so-called invisibility factor. Partly because faith is a mystery that can only be known by experiencing it. It can't be approached by reason. I think faith is plausible to reason after you've experienced the fruits of spiritual faith. But that's a big leap for a lot of people, and faith is a leap.
Mm-hmm.
To know and be known and to love and be loved and to be told that there's a superhuman ministry for you on that basis, that you are known and you're cherished. Not only are you loved, I mean, you're cherished. You really are cherished. It's difficult for a lot of people to believe. I had a conversation with a friend of mine about a year ago, and I said, God knows you personally. That is, the Infinite Father knows you personally, individually. His eyes got wide, and he said, that's impossible. He just wouldn't accept that idea. But he believed in God. I mean, he was a believer. That wasn't the issue. He just found that to be incredible, not believable, that he was known personally. And I've seen that reaction from some other people. The idea that angels would know you is more believable because they're closer to us. But it's all part of the same package. It's all part of the same universe. It's all interconnected. And the angels are here because of the providence of God. God is the universal Father, has made provision and delegated powers and virtues to a number of beings. And one of the final results is having angels that are fairly close to humans in many ways, in terms of intellect and emotion in some respects, but are close to us, literally close to us. I mean, they're here, we're speaking now, and they're with me as I speak, they're with you as you speak, and they're with all of our listeners, I believe, as they listen or call in or write in. But it's hard for a lot of people in the modern context, the modern humanistic, social, secularized context. And I'm a big student and fan of the Renaissance and the humanism of the Renaissance and the Greeks and the humanism of the classical Chinese tradition. But I think in the 20th century, humanism went unintentionally had a digression in terms of separating faith and reason and universe romancing from the so-called practical things of living, daily bread, and which is important. But there is a separation of mind and spirit, if you will, or consciousness and spirit. And a lot of people don't realize, they do believe they're alone in a fundamental sense. And it's dreadful to see it in older people who are in the twilight of their lives, have nobody visit them. You can see in their body language, in their face, the how shrunken they become, because there's no richness. The richness of may have been there or not there is gone or diminished if it was there. The knowledge of angels can help to mitigate that. I think it's an important ministry. I think it's important knowledge. And it does serve as an antidote to human. It can and may serve as an antidote to human suffering. And insecurity and fear is fueled by insecurity. Next paycheck, next job. What am I going to do now? I'm retired. What am I going to do? Children have left the house. What am I going to do? There's so many myriad of sources of insecurity. The way to counter that is to foster relations between persons, both human and divine, both human and spirit. And that includes God, and includes in some form, whatever you conceive them to be. It includes friends, family, neighborhood. It includes angels. The relations between persons, fundamentally, I think, is the reason for human existence, or any existence, all existence. Everything else is secondary. I think that's the greater context that our connection to angels and their connection to us fit.
Well, that is just such a profound and beautiful thought, Charles. Thank you so much for that. I just posted that to the board. The way to counter insecurity is to foster relationships with persons, whether human or divine. Wow.
Go ahead,
Christy.
I was just going to say, it does seem that that is one of the areas where we have the most confusion on this world, in this lifetime, about the nature of relationships. The nature of love. You know, what love really means. What is unselfish love? What is more divine approaches to love? What are more divine approaches to love? How can we do a better job of loving? It's paramount to character development. And it's so confusing for so many of us. And I think this is another area where our seraphic guardians, our angelic mentors, help us
Mm-hmm.
Help us learn how to be in relationship with each other. And how to build qualities of relationship and unselfishness. And learning how to serve one another with the same type of understanding love that they serve us.
Mm-hmm. Love has amazing attributes. There are two great statements about God. God is spirit and God is love. And I would add those to the angels. Courage promotes bravery, but love can provide courage even greater than courage itself. Love, by eliminating fear, love can obliterate fear. But it can do more than that. It can also heal. It's astounding. It's amazing. And unselfish love, that's a term we use, Crystal. Unselfish love, God's love, the love of our angels, the love of true parents without condition, the love of a real teacher, a true teacher. There were students I got along with more than others, but I had no favorites. I never showed favoritism. My affection for them was a commonality. And I made that very clear. That's so important. It's so, so important. I believe the angels' ministry has some of the effects of it is in the way of this kind of unselfish love. The healing, the reassurance, the encouraging, the tendency to obliterate or at least diminish fear. It's probably limitless in what it can do.
I think that's really true. It's limitless. And many people feel heartbroken by so many things. But let's say when someone goes away or when someone chooses to leave us or when... Let's say when we're talking about children, when they leave the nest, when they go off to college or they go off
mm-hmm.
into the world to seek their fortune. And there's a heartache that goes with the separation from that beloved person. But we understand that a stronger love is the love that gives them the freedom to go. So many of us have experienced something that's quite a bit less than that or not in the same ballpark as that type of unselfish love. And that quality of love, which really cares about, really cares more about the other person's well-being than we do about our own pain or loneliness, that is contagious. That type of unselfish love is contagious. And we have to find some way in our little circles or in our mentoring or in our teaching to help people learn more about that quality of love, to demonstrate that quality of love. And I think that's one way in which our angels are very active. They're very interested in helping us to develop that degree of love for our fellow.
Don't you think, too, that the greater part of what you just described, Crystalline, is patience? Being willing to just... I spoke about this at the conference this summer in Montreal, because I think it's a mistake that is so common to human relationships, and the reason that relationships end is because we humans give up on each other. And I think many times we're too quick to give up on each other. I'm not an advocate of toxic relationships, but I think the angels don't give up on us.
No.
And they will never give up on us. And Jesus will never give up on us. God will never give up on us. We have intrinsic value that they will never give up on. But we give up on it. And I think our relationships would be much more satisfying and meaningful for us if we could just hang in there with each other and learn to forgive each other, you know, the bumps in the road kind of thing, and hold on to the real value that's there. Charles, you mentioned earlier, finding the value in a person, seeking and finding that value in yourself, that truth, beauty, and goodness in yourself,
mm-hmm.
but also seeking and finding it in others. And Jesus said, you know, as often his teachings are so profoundly simple, but so profound. As you seek, so shall you find. If you're looking for something to be wrong, that's what you're going to find.
Mm-hmm.
And you may see 1,000 things that are right, but you're not looking for those. You're looking for the thing that's wrong. So that's what you're going to find. And often we humans just tend to hone in on that one. You know, there's another place in the book that says we should learn to view life as basically good with a few unfortunate patches of bad, rather than basically bad with a few patches of good. And I think of the black spot on the wall. You know, the whole wall is white, but your eye just seems to go to the black spot. Because, you know, the contrast of it. But it's good then again to have that perspective that you've been talking about for the whole show, Charles, really. That angelic perspective. Well, the black spot is unfortunate, and we can work on that. But let's not forget to also remember that for the most part, it's the wall is white and good.
This is very real. It's all very real. In my teaching, and teaching a classroom in a public school, teaching high school is about just about as basic and sometimes as raw an experience as it can get in terms of the dynamics of human relationships and all of its ups and downs. I never needed patience very often because of that perspective. You've both characterized what I would call the God perspective, the view from above, the view that realizes that the sum of the parts are not as great as the whole, or the whole is greater than the sum of the parts. And that, I think, is the perspective that angels bring to us, and that we can benefit from them in different ways, probably primarily through prayer and wise living. But nonetheless, the perspective elevates, and it's very practical and attainable and doable. When I said I used prayer as a technique of classroom management, I did, successfully. And when I asked the Spirit of Truth and the angels of these students to help them, oh, be calmer, be more patient, be more thoughtful, to disagree but not be disagreeable, for myself, to be clearer, to be more sensible, to be more reasonable, or for them to be more reasonable with me or with their peers. Those kinds of prayers are very powerful because they speak to character and they speak to growth and relationships, rather important components in existence, human existence. And it's all very, there's nothing. The things we're talking about, these ideals, are not only ideals. They can be lived. And I'm using my experience as a classroom teacher as an example, because I think potentially any teacher could do that, or any parent. But one of the fruits of that was I never needed much patience with him because of that perspective. It hasn't always been the case. I wish it was more the case in my marriage at times. I wish with my own children sometimes was more the case. And I wasn't always patient with my students. I wasn't always that. But it was not easy. It really isn't a case of contrasting easy and difficult. That really isn't the point. It's difficult is relative to what you perceive, and as is easy is relative to what you perceive. I had a student tell me that my teaching, I made managing a class easy. So, well, it appeared to be that way. But there's a lot of ingredients that went into it, a lot of factors that went into it, and I told her some of them, some of what we're talking about this morning. And because she aspired to be a teacher, and but one of the fruits is that as you acquire more and more of a God perspective, you become, in a sense, more sanguine, but also more engaged in life, more engaged in relationships between persons. You become more active, more involved, and sanguine at the same time. It's a wonderful paradox. Or balance, poise. It's I sometimes like to call it spiritual and moral poise, which is just another way of saying balance with some degree of grace, gracefulness. And the angels, when they volunteer for us, when they volunteer for some service, if it isn't guardianship of a person, it's something else. It may be with industry, it may be with the home life, it may be with the races, it may be with nations, it may be with cities. There's all kinds of ways, things with tasks, health, disease, whatever they volunteer to assist humans at achieving something better. They then accept what they have, which speaks to your point, Paula, about the way you were describing patience in that sense of being more forbearing, trying to be more understanding, mm-hmm. not rushing to judgment so quickly, which is a human tendency to rush to judgment. It's understandable, but it's not very helpful. And the angel's perspective, the God perspective, and I'm sure they study this in their own ways as we humans do. All the religions of the world teach that the spirit-led life is a distinct and attainable possibility here and now. They all teach that. They vary in their rituals and symbols and processes and procedures and books. But there are certain commonalities, and that's one of them, that the spirit-led life is attainable. And it's very helpful to know that there are beings, seraphim, cherubim, sanabim, there are beings, angels, they're all angels, different functions, but they're all angels, who value us absolutely as persons. They value us. The value of us as persons is very clear to them. They celebrate that. They embrace that. And in that sense, human beings are very rich. In the mental and spiritual potentials that we humans have, we're very rich. But many people will not believe it. They refuse to believe it. And you can't argue. You shouldn't try to argue with people or convert them or pressure them unduly and that sort of thing. The main approach that I took with my students, because this was my career, but it was also part of my ministry all these years. I've taught for 41 years, primarily high school students. Taught in prison for a year and a half and some other specialized and some private schools. It was primarily public high school teaching. The main approach I took was that I felt that I had to be loyal in exhibiting the values we're talking about, the ideas we're talking about. I tell new teachers, if you want your students to be respectful, then you must respect them. If you want them to be patient, you must be patient. If you want them to listen, you must listen. If you want them to do their homework, you must work hard. So I believed, in looking back on it, my career now, I believe this, what I'm going to say is fully vindicated, is that it starts with one. It starts within yourself. And if you want to transform society, you want to help reform a better society, first transform yourself. But there are some rich assets, living assets. There are, and some of those are angelic. Utilize them.
Right. Hey, you know, that is the perfect place to wind down, because we're out of time. It feels like we just got going, doesn't it?
This 2 hours goes so fast.
I want to thank you both. Thank you very much.
So much. And I hope you will come on again and It's always a delight to talk to you.
I appreciate that.
We appreciate the teacher nature in you.
Yes, absolutely. Such a dear teacher, too, and the kind of teacher that I would hope everybody gets to experience sometime in life.
And thank you to all of our listeners. Yet again, we've reached the end of our show for this week. Join us again next week. And we look forward to seeing you on the chat room and having you call in.
Do I just hang up?
Yes.
I'm new at this. This is the first time I've ever done this. It's been an adventure. I've enjoyed
Thanks
it very
so much.
Much.
We're still on, Charles, and if the listeners can't hear, if you'd like to end with a prayer, that would be really wonderful.
Yes, I will.
Because anybody who listens to the archive will be able to hear it.
Heavenly Father, words cannot really express how grateful we are to be loved and cherished and assisted and helped and guided and guarded by your angels, these wonderful beings of the Creator Mother Spirit. Creator Mother Spirit, we will never probably ever thank you enough. Someday I hope in some fashion, in some way, have a conversation with you about the angels, because they are yours. You're their mother. There's something very noble and very decent, but there's more importantly, there's something very loving in a universe scheme that produces such loving gods and godheads and deities. I can only have affection, Universe Mother, for you and Father because of this love. And I know that, Michael, you are the living water and living bread for us. You sustain us in a living manner. And words will never be able to express what I feel about you, or probably any of us feel about you. You are a continuous discovery of love, as is your partner, Universe Mother, Universe Creative Mother Spirit. And the Father of your Father, as well as our Father, the Father of all of us, all things and beings. I sometimes, when lightning flashes and thunder roars and shadows are cast across my consciousness, all of you are my refuge, our safe harbor. And even the faith that I have, that we have, my friends, my dear friends, my dear colleagues, Paula and Crystal, and all the others have, is a gift from all of you. And the grace that you make this possible, faith possible within us, is a gift. Please help us to understand this, to live this more and more, better and better. And please help us to help our fellows, so many of whom languish in shadows and sometimes pitch blackness, pitch darkness of fear and anxiety and dread and panic and hate and greed and all those unfortunate attachments. Please help us help them. If this conversation we had, this radio blog conversation, has merit, may then the consequences be yours, Father, and Michael, and Mother. Hopefully we have acquitted ourselves. Hopefully I have acquitted myself in a way that has spiritual merit. But may the consequences, may they be receptive to the consequences that you will manage from this interview, this conversation. And may, as we live our lives, continue to live our lives, as I said earlier, please help us to touch the hearts and the minds and the souls of others, our fellows, languish in fear. We're agandantes. We understand. Paula and Crystal and I understand the beauty of that, but so many do not. And may more and more people in this world, agandantes that we are, seek more and more of your grace, your grace, Mother, and your grace, Michael, Father, Brother, and your grace, Infinite Father. And please, I know the angels heard this, but please help them. Please continue to help them to help us. Their work is difficult. They cherish it, but it is difficult. We know how difficult it is. So please help them with your divine grace to help us. And lastly, to you angels who are listening, all of you, the three of us and many of our fellows look forward to meeting you in person in the normal scheme of things in the mansion world. It's a very beautiful prospect. I talk a lot. There are a whole lot of things I want to talk to you about, and a whole lot of things I want to learn about. But in the meantime, we believe in you. We believe in you. We believe all this is for real. We're holding on to that. And I think we're a pretty good team. I believe we're a pretty good team. With your angelic powers and motivations and desires, and our human, I can doubt who they may be, our human motivations and powers and desires. I think we make a good team. And help us with the Urantia book and the Fifth Epochal Revelation to contribute toward turning civilization in this world around and going to higher levels. And lastly, just a personal thing, I want to say again how grateful I am to have the opportunity for the interview, mainly because I am a teacher, and I was hoping, I tried to say things in a way, in a teacherly way, that would reach out to people listening and help them to grow.
Amen. Which you always do, Charles.
Thank
Your
you
sincerity
so much.
Always comes through.
It's been wonderful, ladies, and yes, we'll do it again.
Wonderful.
Okay.
We look forward to it. Have a great day.
It's an interesting experience. Do people normally call in more, or is that typical of how many?
Sometimes more, sometimes less. We don't have that many lines open, so if we have two people holding for, you know, much of the show, if we have more than one guest, we might not, like last week, for example, people were calling in from Jesus' birthday parties around the world, and
wow.
There were several people who couldn't get through because the line was busy. So we have a lot more people who listen to the broadcast in the archive than who listen live.
I see.
But the people who came on the board stayed with us the whole time, and the people who called in to listen, even the one that I couldn't get to respond, stayed on with us the whole time. So they were listening faithfully, and in fact, Reed is still listening. God bless you, bro.
Hello, Reed.
Hey, bro.
So whatever we said, it had value, or they wouldn't have stayed. So that's the good news.
And we've moved up drastically in the ratings in the last month to being in the top 20 or 30 shows on Blog Talk.
Wow.
And as a result of that, we get a lot more people swinging by and dropping in and downloading the shows that might be of interest to them. And angels are always a very popular topic.
Mm-hmm. Wow.
So your words will reach many people. Thank you so much,
yeah.
Charles.
Mm-hmm.
And the archive will stand for quite some time, I think. So.
I just ask us, this is brand new to me, and I'm as you know, a primitive when it comes to this kind of technology. But I that's very meaningful, what you describe.
Yeah.
It's very helpful to me. And I would very much like to do it again. It's been, for some reason, I was somewhat hesitant, but then I am about those things. I don't know why exactly. I mean, I've taught thousands and thousands of kids in hundreds of classrooms. You'd think I'd be used to public speaking, but it seems to be it strikes me as something very worthwhile service. But then you two wouldn't be involved if it wasn't, because that's service is the middle name for both of you.
Oh, thank you.
Thanks.
Well, we do care a lot about this, and we do want to reach people in the most positive ways we can.
Yeah,
and
just like you, we're teachers too.
Yes.
Yes. Well, I've heard about it. People have talked about it. I now have the blog address, and I've become intrigued. So you have won me over.
Well, we hope we'll be able to have you on again, because, as we said, we just barely even scratched the surface of this topic.
And there are so many others you could do well too, Charles.
But
yeah.
We do see this as a really optimum sort of venue for sharing some of the presentations and workshops and seminars that we've gathered over the years. And we hope to be able to share them more generically with people who may not be familiar with the Urantia book, but who very much are thirsting for and hungering for these teachings.
Well, teaching involves always the same basic elements, which are antecedents, the topic itself, and the implications of the topic. And so whenever you take any subject, to address it properly, you always have to bring in, to some extent, the antecedents to it and what the future or potential or implications might be from it. And that makes things more a little more complicated. And I, being very mindful of that, I try to answer with that. I try to speak to those elements to a certain degree. But if we discuss angels in the future, I would rather base it more entirely on people calling in.
Okay. We could definitely do that show. In fact, we could do it soon if you'd like.
Yeah. It would probably be good to go ahead and do it sooner, because this one would be still fresh. And
mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Let's do that. I don't think I can do it next Saturday, because I'm having lunch with Katerina. I think you know Katerina.
Mm-hmm.
Well, that's another whole service potential. But perhaps the Saturday afterwards. Let me get back to you. Should I contact you, Paula, on this?
Sure, either one. Either me
okay.
or Kristen.
All right.
All right.
And,
all right. Well, thank
you so
much.
Have a wonderful week, you guys.
Good day.
And good day to you, too.
God bless.
Much love.
All right.
Bye.
Goodbye.
God's grace be with both of you. Bye-bye.